listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a lot of interesting things in the news today. We're going to be talking. We're going to have another week installment in our Tom Hartman University Book Club today. Dan Sisson, the noted scholar of the Revolutionary era, is going to be with us to talk about the Revolution, the American Revolution of 1800, in our third hour. That should be interesting. The president has cut a deal with President Xi Jinping. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, of China to reduce fossil fuel emissions, carbon pollution in the atmosphere and in our country and his. Republicans, of course, are, really? You're going to cut off the money or the funding or the subsidies for our fossil fuel industry donors? Yeah, we'll talk about that as the day goes on. And an interesting what might be a small story, but I think that there are actually are multiple dimensions to this. And actually two pieces to it. In northern Westminster, Massachusetts, a little town in northern Massachusetts, is considering legislation that would ban the sale of cigarettes and other tobacco products in their town. Cigarettes, of course, are responsible for the death of 400,000 Americans a year. More people die of cigarettes every day than have been killed by terrorists in the United States in any of the last half a dozen years. I mean, if you take 2001 out of the loop, probably they'd have been killed by terrorists ever in the United States. And, you know, it raises some interesting issues. Jeff Steyer is on the line with us. He's the director of risk analysis with the National Center for Public Policy Research, conservative think tank, nationalcenter.org, that typically takes the position of business over people. Hey, Jeff, welcome.
We actually take the interest of individuals who believe in freedom, both in the private sector and individuals themselves who like to have choices. But
yeah, and those individuals, you say freedom, you mean freedom of the billionaires and the corporations to run things. I get it.
Well, actually, yeah. we're actually against corporate cronyism, so I'll take issue with that.
Well, then why don't you tell the Koch brothers to stop taking all those fossil fuel subsidies?
Well, I think Tom Steyer is now... who, no relation, by the way, Jeff Steyer here,
yeah.
Has been investing in banks that are promoting frequent flyer miles. So we could make that argument, but I'm happy to talk with you about our issue today.
Yeah, and this is an interesting one. This town is banning tobacco products. I'm on record, and I stand behind it, as saying that we should not be using the force of government to ban anything that you can grow in your backyard. Period. But that's a very different, and in other words, I don't have a problem with people using or abusing drugs. The concern I have is when it becomes commercial.
Well, I'm happy to hear you, and I've been on with you before, and you're always very straightforward and honest, and we don't always get that from public policy makers who try to claim, oh, well, we're trying to protect kids or whatever it is.
Right.
I think it's honest of you to acknowledge that what you're against is the corporate interest. And we could have a discussion on those grounds. But very often this argument gets couched in, well, we're trying to protect kids from tobacco, and therefore we're going to ban all tobacco, even sales to adults. So I think we're off to a good start in terms of here's what we're here to talk about. We're, again, you are taking the position that this would be a good law, banning all of tobacco sales, because we don't want corporations to make money off.
No, that's not true. I think that it may be a good law if it's the will of the community. I think a community, when it comes to commerce, a community should be able to regulate commerce, right? I mean, this is fundamental to the founding of our republic. It's in the Constitution for our national community.
So we're on the
same
page.
One of the power. Yeah, I think we may well be, actually. And what you're suggesting, you wrote this op-ed saying that, you know, there was this faux pas or kerfuffle or whatever. President Obama's a longtime smoker, and he's apparently taken up chewing nicotine gum now. And he was chewing gum.
By the way, corporations are making lots of money off of that.
Of course. And as I said, this is not, I don't see this as a pro or anti-corporate issue. I suppose it could be. But let me set that aside for a moment.
Is that you're concerned about the commercialization of this, commerce.
Yes. No, well, actually, I am concerned apropos of this situation, and to finish the sentence I started before, President Obama was chewing nicotine gum in China. That was viewed as an insult by the Chinese. You're saying, hey, we'll send you some e-cigs and you can vape nicotine, and you know, which is heavily addictive, five times more addictive than heroin. But the side effects of just nicotine addiction are pretty minimal. In fact, it seems to actually even have some neuroprotective effect. People who are long-term nicotine users are less likely to get Alzheimer's, although they're less likely to live long enough to get Alzheimer's. That we don't know if that's what's skewing the stats. But nonetheless, if the president wants to chew nicotine gum or wants to vape nicotine or whatever, you know, that's fine with me. I get what you know.
And we at the National Center are sending him a package of a variety of different e-cigarettes so he can choose which form of nicotine he wants, because people think, partially, in fact, because of his CDC director, have been making the argument that e-cigarettes are somehow almost as dangerous as smoking, when that's not the case. So I would love to see people like the president, who is still addicted to nicotine, have a choice and use things like e-cigarettes, which are a lot less harmful than smoking cigarettes.
I agree. And that said, if the president lived in a town that decided that they wanted to say, yeah, you're welcome to vape cigarettes, you're welcome to nicotine, you're welcome to chew it, you just can't buy it here, which is a very different thing. This is throwing drug abuse into the realm of public health rather than throwing it into the realm of criminal justice.
Yep.
Right. And I think we both are opposed to pretty much any drug being in the realm of criminal justice. Do I have that right, Jeff?
I'm a libertarian.
Yeah. Okay. So you and I agree that all drugs should not be regulated by the criminal justice system, and people who have problems with those drugs should have easy and rapid availability to a healthcare system of some sort. We would view that system very differently. I think we should have a single payer system, and you think, people who have enough money should be able to hire a doctor, right?
Well, I think the market is good at allocating resources. But I think, you know, what drives me nuts about discussing these issues with progressives like you is that you are very rational. So it makes it a very interesting conversation to have. So what you're arguing is, so long as the public in that municipality thinks banning tobacco is a good idea. Sales of tobacco. You could grow it in your backyard, I guess.
Yeah. Or your brother could bring you some. I mean, you know.
So if that's the argument, I think you're right that they ought to have the right to do that. I would argue that on public policy grounds, it is an ineffective way of achieving the mission of reducing the toll of tobacco, reducing profits off tobacco, because especially in a small town like this, it's very easy to go to another city, state to buy it.
Yeah, I don't absolutely disagree with that. But on the other hand, if you look at all the really effective social movements in history, they started someplace. And, you know, if we're going to have...
As did a lot of the bad ones. So that's not a good reason.
No, it's a very good reason. If we're going to ultimately end up with a tobacco-free country, which would save the lives of 500,000 Americans a year, which is a good thing. I think that's a goal that we can all salute. Then stopping the tobacco companies from promoting their products, both to adults and, frankly, to kids, and you and I both know that they're doing that, is a good start.
Well, I don't know that big tobacco companies today are doing that. I would question that. I would certainly say that we're seeing sales of candy-flavored Nicorette gum. Maybe that appeals to children. I don't know. But you get down, you really boil it down here to, do we want to live in a world without tobacco? And I think that gets into what I call the end game. What is the end game for tobacco control? Do we want to live in a world where people do not have a choice to enjoy tobacco products? And maybe do we want to live in a world where people don't have a choice to enjoy other risky behaviors? I enjoy skiing. It's dangerous. I don't want the government to ban that.
Yeah, I think that's a weak argument. Jeff, we'll live the debate another day. Jeff Steyer with nationalcenter.org. Hang on just a second, Jeff.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Jeff, thanks a lot for being with
us. Thanks, that was fun.
Yeah, good talking with you. National Center for Public Policy Research. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And this thing with China, this is fascinating. President Obama and President Xi Jinping, is that, I don't know how to say his name. Anyway, the President of the United States and the President of China agreeing to cut emission standards back to where they were in 2000, below where they were, 30% below where they were in 2005. Now, why are they not choosing to cut them back to 30% below where they are right now? Because they've grown substantially since 2005. So there's a little bit of sleight of hand here, but it's still a laudable first step. And beyond that, it raises the issue, which I think is not inconsequential. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's on your mind today?
Well, I want to talk about the China-U.S. effort to reduce carbon. Mm-hmm. I think we have the canary in the mine shaft here. In São Paulo, Brazil, there's a city of 9 million people, men, women, and children, their pets, and they're running out of water. All the reservoirs are running dry. And why? Because they've been cutting down, burning the Brazilian rainforest to use for crops like palm oil and cattle, the grazing of cattle. And so now it turns out that forests create evaporation, and those evaporations turn to clouds. And these were known as the flying rivers. These clouds would go over São Paulo and bring the water. Well, the flying rivers have stopped. And so what are these people going to do? Where are they going to immigrate out to? Nine million people. It's like city of New York or something. And they run. You turn on the tap, there's no water. And it's getting worse. And they're not getting any water. Here in California, we have the severe drought. So it really is time. But I think that we can see it as an opportunity. And a couple of things that I would suggest is the worldwide carbon gas tax, new vehicles using brushless electric hub motor wheels so we can move on to electric vehicles, the replanting of our urban, suburban, recreational, and national forests to help cool our planet and turn a lot of the man-made carbon back into oxygen, and switching away from fossil fuels to renewables, especially those that don't use water, like photovoltaics, light to electricity, thermoelectrics, heat to electricity, and piezoelectric pressure to electricity. And those are some of the suggestions I have.
Yeah, well, and they're all good ones. I think that we're going to – I don't even think. It's obvious. We are seeing an increasing level and with an increasing frequency, an increasing level of intensity and with increasing frequency, warning signs that man-made global warming is causing serious problems for not just the planet but for we humans. And the question is going to be how we react to this. I was unfamiliar with this story out of Sao Paulo. Where is it being reported, Harvey?
Go to Google, put in the words São Paulo, Brazil drought, and all the articles come up. And the three scariest words, another thing you can look up, the three scariest words in the English language today are runaway greenhouse effect, runaway greenhouse effect. And right. I think it can happen here because events trigger other events. And before you know it, we'll start to look like Venus.
Yeah, well, that's the tipping point issue that we talk about in the last hour's video over at Green World Rising. Thank you very much, Harvey. Good talking to you. Thanks for calling. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. So this raises interesting questions, I suppose, about governance and how we govern ourselves and, you know, what do we do about these, you know, because I'm opposed to the drug war, and yet I'm also opposed to tobacco companies promoting a product to us that, when used as directed, has basically one consequence, and that's death. Once people are addicted to nicotine, they pretty much are no longer getting pleasure from it. They're diminishing the pain of withdrawal. A nicotine addict experiences withdrawal symptoms 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 times a day. You know, just count the number of cigarettes they smoke, and you know, before every one, what prompts that is withdrawal symptoms. So, you know, I don't have a problem with people smoking tobacco. I don't have a problem with people growing tobacco. It's their choice. But a $1 billion industry promoting tobacco? I have some concerns about that. Pot, now, where do you take this, you know, with other drugs? Pot has apparently some rather substantial medicinal effects from, you know, being better as a sleeping pill than these, you know, highly addictive sleeping drugs out there to being better as a painkiller than the highly addictive and deadly narcotics, you know, things like that. And you know, more effective as a recreational drug and far less toxic than alcohol. But I don't want to play, you know, school marm scold and say, well, this is how it has to be. On the one hand. On the other hand, I think that, you know, as a public health matter, particularly as more and more of the cost of 400,000 people a year dying from tobacco and another million or two being disabled by it. You see these ads on TV for these new drugs for COPD. This is what happens when people smoke for years. I forget the name of the word. What is the disease that people get in their lungs? Emphysema, yeah. I mean, this is, you know, we used to just call it emphysema. Now we call it chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or, you know, whatever. You know, lungs are clogged up. So how do we deal with this? I mean, tobacco actually is a sacred, you know, among Native Americans. It's native to North America. The Europeans discovered it when they came here. Sir Walter Raleigh was one of the first to commercialize it in Europe, thus the tobacco company named after him. And for a while, there was a brand of cigarettes called Raleigh's. And, I mean, maybe they're still around. I haven't seen them in a long, long time, but I don't much watch tobacco. And, you know, speaking as a former smoker myself and user of other drugs, I have some familiarity with these issues. So should the president be chewing nicotine gum in China? Should he be vaping nicotine? I mean, that makes sense to me because you get an instant buzz or instant diminution of withdrawal symptoms. You know that, you know, what you're taking is dealing with something. And the side effects, as I said, of nicotine, and we don't have a lot of really good studies on this, but it appears that most of the damage that smoking does is from burning vegetable matter. It's one of the reasons people are vaping pot now, so you don't get burning vegetable matter. It's like, you know, this is a good thing. Okay, so there's that issue, which I think is fascinating, that this town is talking about banning tobacco. There was a great graphic that I believe is just, you know, generally wild on YouTube. It's gone viral. It asks, why is Denmark the happiest country in the world? And then they have a picture of a bunch of kids in front of a bunch of vegetables, and it says free childcare. It's got a picture of a smiling nurse, and it says free health care. A picture of a bunch of students, and it says free university. A picture of some people working in a fast food joint, and it says $20 minimum wage. And a picture of a guy sitting at his desk working with his feet up on the desk, it says 33-hour work week. Which raises an interesting question. I was thinking about this morning on the metro, on the subway, and I called up Louise and had a conversation with her about it as I was coming into the studio this morning. You look at Denmark. Free child care, free health care, free university, $20 minimum wage, 33-hour work week. The happiest country on earth. Is it possible to have the rich people and the corporations get what they want and have working people get what they want? Free child care, free health care, free college, a decent minimum wage, and a reasonable work week. And that was my starting question, my starting point. Is it possible? Because it seems like we're doing this battle constantly against corporate interests and very wealthy people who are fighting for tax breaks and deregulation. And I've come to the conclusion that it's not possible. Now, maybe you know a way that it is possible, but I can't think of one. And I've been, you know, I'm back with Marx's original 1860-something or other analysis, or 1840s, I guess it was, analysis of capitalism, that there's always going to be this tension between the people who own capital, that is the capitalists, the wealthy and the industrialists, or the corporatists. There's always going to be a tension between them and average working people. And then on top of that, Gaius Publius is writing, and I think it's brilliant, I believe it was over at America Blog, about how Within the Democratic Party, the DLC faction, the Third Way faction, is representing those corporatists.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And with, by and large, the single exception of the Social Security issue, Mark Begich, the guy who the Democrat who just lost in Alaska, just another corporatist. What do we do with this? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very ugly, the very modestly ugly, the good. Senator Angus King, during an appearance on Fox and Friends Tuesday, the Maine senator lit into hosts Brian Kilmeade and Kimberly Guilfoyle for supporting the repeal of Obamacare. King really hit his stride after Kilmeade and Guilfoyle asked him about the latest Obamacare hoopla that one of its architects called voters stupid. Check it out.
We've got 8 million people that have insurance now that didn't before. And don't lecture me about this, because 40 years ago, I had insurance. If I hadn't had it, it caught a cancer that saved my life. If I hadn't had insurance, I'd be dead.
It has to do with the...
It has to do with having insurance, man. If you don't have insurance, it's a high risk.
They just lied about a health plan to the American people, called the stupidity of the American voter, and bragged about the lack of transparency.
This is one guy. I don't know who this guy was. All I know is that it's important for people to have health insurance. And if you guys are saying people shouldn't have health insurance, I don't know where you're coming from. Are you that cruel?
Yeah, they are, actually. I couldn't have said it better myself, Senator. The bad. Stan Solomon, during a recent discussion on his radio show with gun rights extremist Larry Pratt, the conservative talk show host argued in favor of assassinating politicians. I'm not joking. Take a look.
It's hard to get rid of these politicians. They don't want to get out.
That's why we need to have guns. You know what? More than one politician has been dispatched while doing a dance, trying to avoid certain, shall we say, metal jackets.
Well, may their number increase.
All right. Abe Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt got shot. He wasn't killed. Jack Kennedy, Robert Kennedy. Aren't these guys brilliant, these right-wingers? This is bizarre. And the very, very ugly Robert Jennings. The president of Lincoln University is under fire after a video of him making questionable remarks about rape and sexual assault at his university was posted online. Take a look.
And let me tell you why I know I'm right about it. I'm right about it because we have on this campus last semester, had on this campus last semester, three cases of young women who, after having done whatever they did with the young men, and then it didn't turn out the way they wanted it to turn out, guess what they did? They then went to public safety and said, "You raped me." So then we have to do an investigation.
Right. Women report rape when men don't give them what they want. The fact that anyone could think this way, especially someone in charge of educating young minds, is just very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Whew. That's incredibly ugly. So is it possible that Denmark is the happiest country in the world and they could have unconstrained, unregulated, libertarian free market capitalism? I think no. I don't think it's possible. I don't think it's possible to have happy billionaires and happy people. Now, you could say in the United States, we had this period from the 1930s until the 1980s when the billionaires were actually only millionaires and they were quite wealthy, but not, you know, like, not like, you know, nowadays. I mean, it's like, this is, we've got people who have more riches than any king in the history of the world and any empire in the history of the world. I mean, mind-boggling riches. This was not possible prior to the Reagan presidency, because after you made, you know, basically your first $1 million a year, and you do that for 40 years, you got 40 million bucks, right? After you made your first $1 million a year, the top tax rate hit 74%. Most people said, okay, enough. I'll just take the $1 million bucks. put the rest of the money into giving raises to your workers, building new plants, promoting new products, R&D, all kinds of cool stuff. I think that, you know, without regulated capitalism and high taxation on wealthy people, you're not going to be able to have a country that works for the vast majority of its people. 30% of Americans, only 30% of Americans right now are able to actually maintain their lifestyle and not be in debt with the jobs that they have. Only fewer than a third of us. Everybody else is going deeper and deeper in debt all the time. Anyhow, we got that. We got tobacco. Kevin, you wanted to weigh in on the tobacco issue in Missoula, Montana. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine. Am I faint on your end?
No, you're super duper.
Okay, great.
Good morning, and surprise, I'm a little bit stunned because I admire you so much, and you've taught me so well that...
But...
I take exception to your statement that tobacco kills people and that you have a vision for a tobacco-free something, and I think it's ridiculous.
So you think tobacco doesn't kill people?
I would dare to say, for lack of time, let's just say I believe tobacco is a lifesaver, and it has saved my life.
Why and how?
Mental health.
Well, that would be the active ingredient. You're not talking about tobacco. You're talking about the drug nicotine. And I'm suggesting you should be able to take the drug nicotine through a vape, you know, through a e-cigarette or in chewing gum all you want, anytime you want.
No.
I have no problem with the abuse of the drug. And for that matter, I have no problem with you smoking tobacco all you want, anytime you want. My problem is somebody making a profit on it.
Well... Yeah, but then we're kind of stuck in a society that you really, if you want to smoke mindfully and beneficially, you need to have the ability to procure said chemical through the process of an intelligent ability to choose.
Well, no, it's not just choosing, Kevin. I have two problems with smoking tobacco, okay? Number one, it's particularly commercial tobacco because the tobacco industry adds, they freebase the nicotine in there with ammonia. They add ammonia to cigarettes to alkalize the nicotine so it hits you harder and faster and makes you more addictive and keeps you more addicted and causes you to have to consume cigarettes more rapidly because it hits you faster, it flushes out of your system faster, number one. And number two, it's pretty damn difficult to smoke tobacco and not have people around you be exposed to it. Even heroin addicts don't spray their heroin in other people's faces. They don't stick needles in other people's bodies. People snorting cocaine are not blowing it into the air. But tobacco addicts, they're sharing it with everybody. Whereas if you're vaping an e-cigarette with nicotine, very little of that nicotine is ever going to get in the atmosphere because it doesn't come out the end of the vape thing like tobacco does off a cigarette. It only comes through your mouth and into your lungs.
Well, I cannot disagree with anything you just said, Tom. You're absolutely right.
So if somebody wants to make money selling you a drug that helps your mental health, and I get it, you know, as a former smoker myself. And
if I may iterate my point, in that I've been practicing respectful smoking. I respect others around me.
Right.
I procure tobacco that is as pure as I can find it. I'm currently smoking a cigarette, a brand which I won't say, but it's premium tobacco that comes from Norway, and it is a joy for me to roll this cigarette with my fingers and feel the tobacco and feel the difference between this tobacco versus another tobacco. And there's so many different varieties to choose from.
Right.
I like to think of myself as a introduction to tobacco aficionado.
So you're a connoisseur of tobacco. I get it, Kevin. And I mean, there are connoisseurs of alcohol and wine, which kills 50,000 people a year. And you know, I, which I think that we do a fairly decent job of regulating in our society, but there are communities around the United States that do not allow the sale of alcohol. And my argument, my point was that if a community wants to get together and say, you know, we're not criminalizing tobacco or nicotine, we're simply saying it can't be commercialized in our community, I support that community's ability to say that.
Effect on users, then?
No, it's on sellers. Users can still, I mean, if you can, you could grow tobacco in your house, you could grow tobacco in your backyard. I don't know how easy or difficult it is.
I cannot grow tobacco as good as what I'm holding in my finger right now.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're right. And if you can acquire it outside of your own town, you know, it's like, you're the city fathers of Northfield, Massachusetts, or whatever the town is here, Westminster, Massachusetts, excuse me, would apparently have no problem with that. It raises an interesting question. If you order it online and it comes to you in the mail, apparently that would be legal because it wouldn't be a sale that is regulated by the city. It wouldn't be a sale that's happening within the city limits, which kind of blows up a lot of arguments about where commerce can and can't be regulated. I get your point, Kevin. I absolutely get your point. But I think that the rights of smokers have to be balanced by the rights of people who are non-smokers, and which includes kids. Although I don't want to make the gratuitous "it's for the children" argument. Kevin, thank you for the call. And enjoy your cigarette. We'll be back 15 minutes past, before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls right after this. It's quarter to 2. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Vince, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Pomeroy, Iowa. Hey, Vince, what's up?
Well, I'm just calling to pick a nit with you, Tom. First time, long time.
Thank you.
You opined that it was burning vegetable matter that was primarily responsible for the cancers.
No, actually,
I admit that there have been studies where pot not only didn't cause cancer, but suppressed it.
You're right. Yeah, long-term pot smokers are less likely to get lung cancer than long-term non-smokers. But there's also a number of active ingredients inside pot that are, specifically anti-cancer. So, you know, nobody's making that suggestion about tobacco. The tobacco industry has had, 50 years and millions of dollars thrown at good science to look for such things, and they don't find them. But if your point is that it's the additives in tobacco that are destructive, I agree with you. I used to own a company that sold herbal teas and herbal smoking mixtures back in the early 70s, and we got all these things from the companies that sell these flavorings to the tobacco industry. And I got all these little 1 ounce jars. I had probably 40 of them, the different flavorings that were available for tobacco. We ended up not using any of them because they were poisonous. I mean, they were labeled as poisons. You couldn't get them on your hands. You couldn't consume them. And yet they put them in tobacco routinely because tobacco is not GRAS. It's not regulated by the FDA or the USDA. It's not generally regarded as safe. In other words, it's not considered a food product. And even though, it ends up inside your body. I'm with you, if that's your point.
Exactly. Now, if we move on to the next question about what does the Democratic Party have to do to survive the corporatists?
Yeah.
We have to have a strong populist movement from the grass up to just overwhelm them and tell them to go back to the Republican Party.
I agree. And this is what Bernie Sanders is talking about doing, and I think it's a noble effort. And
I'm praying that he goes ahead and votes and runs. Sanders Warren would be a great ticket in 16. It would be Hillary would be guaranteed to turn off the millennials.
Yeah.
But that's my opinion. Have a nice show.
Thank you very much, Vince. Good to hear from you. Tricia watching Free Speech TV in Lucerne, California. Hey, Tricia.
Hi. We have a county in Northern California that grows a lot of pot, and they just passed a ballot measure called Measure N that said we can't grow anywhere in our backyard.
Hmm.
But, and it's totally limited throughout the county. and it's part of our whole economic base. You know, people grow pot and they put it back in for, into the economy from the bottom up.
Yeah.
You know, you pay people to trim your pot and they can, you know, get their car fixed or buy food or whatever. And we're a poor county, so, and a lot of it is just small people, moms and pops, growing in their backyard.
Right.
And that's called commercializing it.
Yeah, and so your town has banned that.
The whole county has.
Have they
banned
the growing of it or the sale of it? Because
they banned the growing of it. You can grow a little tiny bit, 10 by 10, in a garage.
Yeah. Well, 10 by 10 will produce a lot of pot. But still, Tricia, very interesting. Thank you. I'm going to have to ponder before I opine. 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Maybe I missed mentioning this at the very beginning of the hour. 603-786-2922 is the number for Hunter School. We are in our fundraising drive this week. Our holiday, you know, we're kind of close to the end of the year. This is a tax-deductible charity, and we're trying to put new roofs on a couple of buildings and get some stuff done there and put together a scholarship fund. And Hunter School is hunterschool.org is the website. It's just an absolutely great organization. And Jeannie Haas, am I saying that right, Jeannie?
Jeannie Haas, yes.
Jeannie Haas is with us. She is the mother of one of our students, at one of the kids who is attending Hunter School. Jeannie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Tell us, you know, I don't want to invade your or your son's privacy here, so I'll let you decide, you know, what you want to share and what stories you'd like to tell about your and your son's experience at Hunter School.
Yes. This is such a privilege because this is my favorite subject to talk about. My son entered Hunter School a year ago at the age of 9, and at that point he was this is really a miracle story, and that's why it's so exciting. He entered a year ago with a laundry list of diagnoses as well as limitations on how he could function. He was essentially nonverbal, wasn't reading, and did things like bolted into the street. He was, at that point, almost considered a danger to himself or others. And I'm so passionate about this. I know that there's, you know, some privacy issues here, but my son has been transformed, basically, by the Hunter School, the people there, and the philosophy behind it. Just to give you, I mean, there's a in just that short period of time, in less than a year, at the end of the spring, he got the most peaceful award. So clearly, this school has changed his life, and I believe, and my life as well, and really the trajectory, I think, of where he was going to end up. And I could talk all day about him. I'm so excited and so passionate about the Hunter School.
That's absolutely great. And just to remind folks, with a $100 contribution to the Hunter School, we will send a Be the Light t-shirt or umbrella, your choice. With a $1,000 contribution to the Hunter School, you can come to Washington, D.C., and Louise and I will take you out to dinner, and you can hang out at the TV show or the radio show. We're talking with Jeannie Haas, who is the mother of one of the kids who is at the Hunter School right now. Jeannie, what do you think it is about Hunter School that saved your son's life or helped your son... move in a positive direction. Let's tone down the rhetoric here.
Yeah, it really did save his life, I think, because just historically we were told about his limitations. Mm. The emphasis seemed to always be on his limitations, and it got to the point where, even as a very young child, I was told he might not ever really speak in a functional manner. He probably won't do pretty much anything that a typical child would do. That's how limited... Actually, not how limited he was, but how limited the professionals around him saw him. Mm. And how we were influenced to take that on as well. And what I've come to really see there in the people at the Hunter School is that the mindfulness piece is huge. The fact that the staff does not come with limitations that they place on the children. They come from a place of acceptance and love, and they really very different from the standard way of teaching and dealing with these kids, is that instead of putting their hands on them and like, I'm going to fix you, if they take their hands off and they, in themselves, they're peaceful, that comes out onto the children. And the children feel that, they incorporate that day after day. It's from a peaceful place. And although we've had bumps along the road, as any child would, just because of, testing, I believe my son, when he was testing, it was, are you going to love me when I'm not perfect? Are you going to love me when I don't look like I'm progressing? Are you going to accept me as I am right now in this not-so-great place? And over and over and over, the answer was yes. The answer was yes, instead of, no, you have to change before I accept you or before you can move on. And I've seen, so to answer your question, it's a combination, I think, instead of just the program, I think the people are the program. The people have incorporated this mindfulness piece and living in a very different fashion, just themselves. They have that within themselves. That acceptance comes out, and our kids embrace it. And I can't say enough. Even on the property itself, Tom, when I first drove him up there, when I first came up by myself, you could just feel the peace.
Mm-hmm.
You could feel a difference there. And when I took my son up, he was one who would do things like bolt out into the street or run around the school or just take off. And multiple different times at different schools, he did that. But at Hunter, after being there just 10 minutes, I said, what do you think? And again, this is a child who virtually was nonverbal and who said very few words. He looked right at me and he said, stay at school. And that was not coming from a place where he was filtering out all kinds of things in his mind. He was feeling that love and acceptance from the minute that we got there. And he was telling me, this is where I need to be. This is where I belong.
Wow.
So.
And he has improved substantially?
He's doing things that we never thought he would do. He's reading his math skills. A lot of the subjects that they are teaching now, he's almost at grade level. And we're talking a kid who was told it was just such a doom and gloom, judgmental kind of future that was put on him. He's doing things. He's drumming. My favorite story is that for years I tried to teach him how to ride a bike. He was so filled with anxiety, fear.
And he's now riding a bike? Jeannie, we're running out of time here.
Oh, yeah. He didn't know he couldn't ride a bike.
That's great. Jeannie, thank you so much for being with us.
To Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I found this absolutely fascinating. We're going to get the fellow who wrote this on tomorrow, Michael Price. But he's talking about he just bought a new TV set, a new smart TV. Well, you know, okay, we're gonna talk to him about it tomorrow. So I will bring this topic up tomorrow. I shouldn't preempt my own show. Here I asked the other question. You can just hang out of that. I asked another question earlier. Is it possible for unregulated capitalism? You know, the type of capitalism that libertarians and by and large Republicans are in favor of, where government has a very limited role in regulating capitalism and basically the capitalists run the show. Is it possible to have a functioning democratic society, small d democratic society, that produces one of the or arguably all of the criteria that Thomas Jefferson defined in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Is it possible to produce that for the majority of people in a capitalist society, with unregulated capitalism? Now, I'm not a total opponent of capitalism. I am an opponent of laissez-faire capitalism, of unregulated capitalism, of capitalism where the capitalists make the rules and the rest of us get stuck with the rules. Let's keep in mind, there are probably only a few tens of thousands, maybe 100,000, but not a lot of actual capitalists in the United States. Capitalists are people who earn their living with capital. Laborers are people who earn their living by their work. And there's a very significant difference between the two. Capitalists earn their living using their money, investing their money, sitting around the pool, you know, waiting for the dividend check to arrive. Sometimes more actively using their money the way Mitt Romney did. Buy a company, lay off the workers, move the factory to China, jack up the profits, take the money. Hey, that's what capitalists do. So is it possible for capitalism in a relatively unregulated fashion, as we have by and large in the United States right now, and as we had in the United States in the 1920s, and we did not have in the United States from the 1930s until arguably the late 1980s. Instead, during that period of time, we had heavily regulated capitalism. You know, you get all these Republicans and these billionaires and the shills for the billionaires and the shills for the big corporations running around going, you know, like their hair on fire. Oh, my God, the regulations, it's killing America. All these small businesses have vanished because of regulations. I'm sorry, I run a small business and I haven't noticed any regulations. Oh, it's the taxes. They're killing. Their small businesses in America generally don't pay taxes. I mean, they certainly contribute to economic activity. They pay their employees. They split the FICA with them. There is money that goes to the federal government, but the taxes are paid by companies like Apple that make hundreds of or ExxonMobil that make hundreds of millions, tens of billions of dollars in profits. And particularly now are trying to shelter those by keeping them offshore in the hopes that the day will come when there's a Republican president and a Republican Congress and they'll say, gee, let's just declare a holiday, a moratorium. All these big companies, Apple's got $100 billion sitting offshore. They can bring that home. And instead of paying, you know, the maximum 40% corporate income tax, what with deductions and everything else would probably work out between 20 and 25%. They can bring it home for 3% or for free. This is what they're all working on right now, right? This repatriation. Bring home the money. Right. Sounds nice. It's a great slogan. It makes a great bumper sticker, which is what the Republican Party is all about. If you can reduce it to a bumper sticker and get people to say it and repeat it, and they think they know what they're talking about and they don't, then that's a Republican issue. So the question, can you have a well-educated, safe, secure, healthy, happy populace and have unregulated capitalism? Jefferson's three criteria, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How can you have life if you are sick and you don't have access to health care because you can't afford it? So, you know, we are the only country in the world that does not have, the only developed country in the world that does not have a national health care system of some form or shape. I mean, the Switzerland doesn't have a national healthcare system. It's run by the government, but the government does require everybody in Switzerland to buy health insurance, and they have to buy it from a nonprofit organization, so it doesn't cost very much. But everybody is insured in Switzerland, have to be. Other countries, England, they have the National Health Service in England. It's actually owned by the government, by the people. You have other countries that have single-payer healthcare systems, like this, most of the Scandinavian countries, where the government doesn't own the clinics or employ the doctors, but they pay the bills. But how do you have life in the United States, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, Declaration of Independence? How do you have life if you're sick and you can't afford to go to the doctor? You don't. So we have not yet, you know, Obamacare has taken us a step forward, but we have not yet met the founding ideals of this country. So that's life. Liberty is the second one. How can you have liberty in a society run by oligarchs and plutocrats? Now, we had a guest on in the last hour who is, you know, representing an organization that's funded in part by oligarchs and plutocrats, saying, you know, we're a freedom agenda. People should be free to make their own choices. Right. So you're sick and you can't afford to go to the doctor. You're hungry and you can't afford to buy food. You want to work, but there's no jobs because the capitalists moved all the jobs to Vietnam and China and Honduras and whatever. Are you free? Do you have liberty? I mean, we know that for the roughly half of Americans who live at or below the poverty level, they're not, you know, their right to life is significantly impaired. Tens of thousands of them die unnecessarily every year. What about their right to liberty? Franklin Roosevelt said, a necessitous man, in other words, somebody who doesn't have their basic necessary needs met, a necessitous man is not a free man. You are free when you have a job that pays enough money that you can have a home and you can raise your kids and you can take a vacation and you can and your debt and you can live debt free. That's freedom. That's liberty. Now, the libertarians and the right wingers and the Republicans would want you to think that liberty and freedom means something else. I mean, they throw out this abstraction. We are a liberty agenda, a freedom agenda. And what does that mean? Well, it means that the Koch brothers can pollute the rivers all they want with their paper factories for Georgia Pacific, or that they can pollute the air all they want with Koch Industries, oil refineries, or they can throw as much carbon in the atmosphere as they want with all the tar sands that they own up in Alberta in Canada, and then ship it down to the Gulf Coast where they can refine it in their refineries and then sell it to China. That's freedom. What about my freedom to live in a planet that isn't melting down as a consequence of their freedom? Well, that's not the kind of freedom Republicans and libertarians are talking about. So there's life, liberty, and then happiness. How can you be happy if you're hungry? How can you be happy if you're homeless? How can you, we have debunked the idea that money buys happiness. But there actually is a kernel of truth to it. The first $30,000 to $50,000, or really $20,000 to $50,000 that a person earns every year, depending on where they live, makes a huge difference in the quality of their happiness. After that, you make $100, $200, $300, $400. It doesn't seem to have much effect. In fact, a lot of money can make people miserable.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But the simple fact is, because of unregulated capitalism, because the Supreme Court has turned our media over to these guys, there's a lot of Americans who don't even have the right to happiness. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Russ, Russell, hang on. You're listening to WCPT. Let me get Patty, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in the Dalles, Oregon. Hey, Patty, what's up?
Oh, yeah. Tom, I was just, thanks so much for what you do. I really appreciate it all.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to ask you what you thought about these, now that we have a Congress that's 100% Republican and probably a majority of wimpy Democrats, how are they different from those hookers that line the boulevard at night and wait for somebody to come along and buy their bodies?
There's a substantial difference between the two. What the hookers are doing is illegal, and if they get arrested, they can go to jail. What Congress is doing is totally legal, according to the Supreme Court. And so when they take money in exchange for their votes and in exchange for their public proclamations, what they're doing is legal. Beyond that, and there are, you know, some hookers who actually, I believe, you know, if you, from what I've read, I'm not a hooker and I'm not a woman, so it's hard for me to really know this. But my understanding is that there are some hookers who at least in some phases of their careers, enjoy what they do. You know, very well paid, have a very selective clientele, they like sex, whatever. I'm not sure that there's a lot of members of Congress who enjoy, well, maybe they do. Maybe they love the power. Maybe that's another parallel. Maybe, you know, when Paul Ryan got busted for having a $600 bottle of wine with dinner, 2 years ago, I guess it was, he probably enjoyed that. So, yeah, maybe it's a reasonable analogy. What do you think,
yeah,
Pat?
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. I was going to say, do you think that 2014 is going to mark the official mark at the end of our democracy?
No. I think that we are far more resilient than we are giving ourselves credit for. We have been through these cycles before. We were very anti-democratic in the 1880s. We swung very progressive in the late 1890s, early 1900s. Teddy Roosevelt was kind of the high water mark of that. Then we swung very, very hard right in the election of 1920 with Warren Harding coming in. And from 1921 to 1929, we had a very, very hard right Republican, libertarian, laissez-faire. I mean, you know, Harding's first act of office in 1921 was to drop the top income tax rate on his millionaire and billionaire buddies from 91% down to 25%. And it set up the Great Depression. So, but we, you know, we learned from that. FDR came into power and we woke up and came back. It's the last time we had somebody, even half as good as FDR was LBJ in the 1960s. And he was tragically tarnished badly by the Vietnam War, but his domestic policies were brilliant. And he was the last Democratic president to actually draw a clear line between Democrats and Republicans, to point out that the Republicans were the party of big business, and to advocate on behalf of, you know, average working people. So, but I think that another one will come along. And I think that it's entirely possible that even if, you know, one of the, quote, conventional corporate Democratic candidates like Hillary Clinton gets elected, that if we have enough of an economic crisis, which I believe we're in the midst of right now, and enough people speak up and stand up and speak out, that person could even become a part of this. So we'll see. Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The telephone number for the Hunter School to make a donation. We are this week doing our holiday fundraiser, Christmas, Hanukkah, whatever, you know, Yule log, pagan ritual, whatever you'd like, for the Hunter School. It's a great charity. You were just hearing from the mother of one of the kids there who said that, you know, Hunter School has saved her son's life. And I actually met her son when I was up there earlier in the year. I think it was in May that Louise and I went up to Hunter School. And what a great kid. What a great kid. And so the number, if you would like to help out, you can do it online. You can go to hunterschool.org and just make a donation online. That's pretty straightforward and fairly easy. Or you can call 603-786-2922. 603-786-2922. That's the number for Hunter School. With a $100 contribution, they'll send you a T-shirt, a Be the Light T-shirt or umbrella. And with a $1,000 contribution, Louise and I would be pleased to host you here in Washington, D.C., or take you out to dinner, let's say. I can't pick up your hotel room, so I'm not really hosting you, I guess. But if you can make it to D.C., you're welcome to come by, watch us do the show, hang out, and go to lunch or dinner with Louise and I, whatever you'd prefer. So 603-786-2922 for our fundraiser. Lynn in Cypress, Texas. Hey, Lynn, you had a thanks for watching us on Roku on Free Speech TV. You had a suggestion for the Hunter School?
Yeah, I contributed $100 yesterday, and about 10 minutes after contribution, I got... Oh, you're welcome. But about 10 minutes after the contribution, I received an email from my employer reminding me that they do matching donations.
Whoa.
So I immediately applied for it, but I should have thought of that, but I hadn't. But it might be something you might want to mention when you're doing the fundraising.
That's a great... Well, you just mentioned it, Linda, 3 million people. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's a great suggestion. Contact your employer. Yesterday we had somebody who said federal employees can ask for donations to be taken from their paychecks as well. So there's a lot of ways to give, and talk to your employers about that. Lynn, thank you. Thank you very much. Great. Thank you. Great to hear from you. Rudy in Riverside, Illinois. Rudy, you wanted to get back to tobacco?
Yeah, Tom. I want to tell you a story about how tobacco had a deadly effect on my family. Mm-hmm. It's a tale of two brothers. The oldest brother, a World War II Marine, fought on almost every island in the South Pacific. He died from COPD attributed to smoking cigarettes.
Right.
My other brother recently was diagnosed as having a heart valve condition that's inoperable because of his age. He'll be 84 in January.
Wow.
He's a chain smoker, one after the other.
Wow.
The last time he came to see me from Florida, I said, if you come here, you can't smoke, because I don't allow smoking in my house or anywhere around me. He thought I was kidding. And he's trying to defend smoking.
Well, he's 87, Rudy. I mean, he's 87. That's pretty impressive for somebody who smokes that much.
Yeah, 84.
Oh, 84.
84 yeah. In January, not 87.
Yeah, but still, I mean, you know.
Anyway, some people might think that, man, he could have lived to be 100.
Yeah. Yeah. In other words, he's got really great genes. Okay, Rudy, thanks for sharing your story. Great to hear from you. Umberto in Hialeah, Florida. Hey, Umberto, you wanted to talk about unregulated capitalism. My question for this hour, you know, can unregulated capitalism coexist with the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution?
Well, Tom, first of all, hi. And my answer to that, if you interpret life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness according to the principles of progressivism, the answer would be absolutely not. And the reason why is that unregulated capitalism, which is going to come in hand with libertarianism, is based on the principle of extreme individualism, that I am the only one who really matters. Everybody else has to survive on their own. And of course, a society based on that principle that really there is no government, practically no government protections or guarantees, and whether it's healthcare, education, housing, food, all of the needs of human beings in life, you have to earn it entirely on your own. In a society like that, it's really only people with enough money to buy those things that are really going to enjoy them. So unregulated capitalism and libertarianism, the only thing it's going to produce is massive poverty, massive marginalization of many people, basically abuse of working people and the working class, and it's only going to solidify the oligarchy. I mean, well, first of all, as far as I'm concerned, the oligarchy is already firmly in place, and they're getting their way. They bought this election. And who knows what else they're going to be able to do with all their money.
Yeah, so I'm with you.
So it's actually money that's going to rule in a society of unregulated capitalism and libertarianism, not individual life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So, no, it cannot go hand in hand with a true democracy. It's going to destroy democracy, and we're going to have to find some way to go beyond this distortion that the oligarchs have been able to pull on so many Americans. to defend this kind of unregulated.
Well, that's sort of the bad news, Umberto. The good news is we don't have to reinvent. We don't have to invent anything. We can do what we already did in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and simply regulate capitalism and capitalists.
Exactly. Now, I'm just going to make one quick observation. The only reason why, what I can see, why so many working class people and poor people, particularly those who made it to the polls, why they could have possibly voted for a progressive, you know, referendum on their ballots and yet turn around and still vote for some of the most extreme right-wing Republican candidates, is that the distortion machine of the Republican Party has done its job tremendously, tremendously well.
Yes.
I spoke to a gentleman who voted for Republican candidates in my area, and I asked him, well, did you vote for any of the progressive referendum? And he said, yeah, we had some progressive referendum in our area. And I said, well, why did you vote Republican?
Hang on just a second. I'm
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
10 seconds for your answer.
Okay. And he said, well, because it's big government and the Democrats who are standing in the way of all these changes.
Oh, jeez. The Tom Hartman Program is a charity wine partner with the Organic Wine Company. They donate a portion of their proceeds to the Hunter School for Children with Autism, ADHD, and other learning challenges. The Organic Wine Company was started in 1980 by Veronique Raskin. Her mission is to share her passion for high-quality organic wine with those who enjoy wine. The Organic Wine Company works with winemakers from around the world, produce a wide variety of organic and low or no sulfite wines to complement the organic food on your table. More information at ecowine.com. 28 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here, helping you win the water cooler wars, and Russell in Hickory Hills, Illinois. Hey, Russell, what's on your mind?
Yes. Last night, Tom, I was watching MSNBC. I don't think you want me to mention the show.
I don't, you know, I don't mind. Whatever.
Rachel Maddow brought this up. The Senate Democrats will not confirm this girl in the lame duck session because 15 days are not long enough, and they're going to leave it up to the Republicans.
You're talking Loretta Lynch?
Party. Yeah. They say 15 days is not enough time to get her confirmed, even though we control the Senate.
Here's the problem, Russell. Here's the problem. Originally, the Republicans were refusing to confirm anybody because they could filibuster confirmations. So Harry Reid blew up. He pulled a semi-nuclear option, and he changed the Senate rules so that the Republicans could no longer filibuster confirmations. So now what has happened is Mitch McConnell has said, okay, under the Senate rules, we can require 30 hours of debate on a nominee before we have a vote. So it's called slow walking. They're forcing every single nominee to have a 30-hour debate. Now, that's, you know, keep in mind there are, I think, 7 or 8 legislative days that are going to happen this month and 6 or 7 that are going to happen next month. It's not a lot of days, and each one of those days is only 5 or 6 hours long, and you divide that by 30, you know, divide 30 by that, and what you're looking at is it takes 2, 3, 4, sometimes 5 days in the Senate to get one confirmation through. In the meantime, the federal government is going to shut down. If there's not a continuing resolution or a budget resolution of some kind passed, the president is asking for more money to fight ISIS, regardless of what you think about that. He thinks it's a high priority. There's a bunch of stuff that literally the fate and future of the republic hangs on, and I think by and large, the Democrats are figuring Loretta Lynch, if the Republicans go after her, if they refuse to confirm her after the first of the year, that it's going to mean egg on their face. It's going to look really bad. She's a really good prosecutor. She's gone after people on the left and the right. She's got an amazing track record. She's brilliant, and she's a woman, and she's African-American. All of those things are going to make the Republicans look like, you know, small-minded bigots, basically, among other things, if they go after her after the first of the year. So, you know, it makes a certain, I'm not saying I'm in favor of this, and I didn't see Rachel's show last night. It was our anniversary. I took Louise out for dinner, so I didn't see any TV last night. But if what you're saying is true, I understand why. Am I making sense here, Russell?
Yeah, because, like, when you just said put egg on their face, Here's a party come June, let's be honest, Tom. They're going to gut the ACA in the Supreme Court. They're going to impeach this guy. I mean, this is the way we're going to get gutted. I mean, you know that ACA is going to get gutted in the Supreme Court. They waited till all these people got on, and they're going to impeach this guy when he does immigration.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Russell. I think that both of those things have very high probabilities, not just possibilities, but probabilities. And you know, this is the amazing thing about living in the United States, living in a semi-democratic republic, semi to the extent that the Supreme Court has taken away our individual freedoms and handed them to billionaires. But still, we have some say in things, and we have an electorate that occasionally pays attention. And I think that Republicans, whenever they have power, they always overreach. You know, they throw themselves into the hands of the bigots and the billionaires, and they're going to do it again. And it might be a really good thing for everybody else in 2016. We'll see. But I don't share anybody's indignation about Harry Reid coming up with, you know, strategic timing of events in the United States Senate during the lame duck session. I absolutely understand why he would do that. Russell, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill. Nearly did have Megyn Kelly there. You're on the air. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I was just listening to you talking about capitalism and just kind of some of the descriptions, and I don't know why, for some reason, the first word that came to my mind was antisocial. So just for goose, I looked it up, and antisocial behaviors are actions that harm or lack consideration for the well-being of others. I feel like I just kind of described
right. Well,
in America.
My understanding of antisocial was the first half of that. It's actions that harm people, but not the don't consider people. I think that's asocial. And I would say that corporations are asocial. They are sociopaths, basically. They have no conscience. They're no consideration of humanity.
Well, I got it off Wikipedia, but it says antisocial behaviors are actions that harm or lack consideration for the well-being of others.
Yeah.
And that sounds like antisocial behavior to me, what we're seeing in this country.
I think you're right. And
that was just an observation.
Yeah, no, it's a good one. And I would add to it sociopathy, sociopathic behavior, psychopathic behavior that we're seeing from these billionaires and from these corporations. And it's inherent in the corporate structure, which is one of the reasons why sociopaths do so well running big corporations, because, you know, their brain wiring is similar to the legal wiring of the corporation. Bill, thanks for the call. Excellent one. Luke in St. Charles, Illinois. Hey, Luke, what's up?
Hi. I was listening to your talk about the Constitution and unregulated capitalism, and it reminded me of a book I had read called Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Have you read it?
I have. I don't know anybody who's actually read the whole book. Maybe you have. I would be very impressed. I've read pieces of it.
I managed it.
Wow.
It's a pretty big book if you want, you know, really, really technical things and lots of numbers. But
yeah.
Again, I'm a math major. I don't mind it.
Great.
But my point is the book's premise and what it uses all of its, you know, 600 pages of data to prove is that in capitalistic societies such as the one that we live in, it is inevitable that wealth and capital will continue to move into smaller and smaller numbers of hands, you know, on repeat. So,
right. Lacking regulation that prevents that. Yes.
Right. Which I was wondering what do you think is the best means of at least slowing down, stopping, or reversing this?
I think there's two very straightforward steps that we should be taking right away. The first is to undo the Reagan tax cuts and restore the top income tax rate on very wealthy people back to, you know, well over 50%. And the second is that we need to stop, you know, Reagan stopped in 1982, stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. We need to go back to enforcing it like Richard Nixon did when he broke up AT&T. It finally resolved itself, or he initiated the process. It was the Jimmy Carter administration that saw the final breakup of AT&T. Just basically say having every industry sector in the United States controlled by three or four corporations is not good for the United States. It's not good for business. It's only good for those three or four corporations. We should say that, you know, 80% of an industry cannot be controlled by more than X number of companies. And we need to figure out what that X is. Is it 10? Is it 20? Is it 50? Is it 100? Is it 500? That would be a place to start. That would be a really, really good place to start. I wrote a book called Rebooting the American Dream, and it's got 11 steps in it to restore American democracy. Those are two of them. But I would say if you were to, and that book, by the way, you can read it for free over at truthout.org. We put the entire book online. It's got a bunch of things. Go ahead, Luke.
If you pick an arbitrary number of companies, though, to own a certain industry or a certain percentage of an industry, don't you run into like problems like, you know, how Pepsi and Coke are universally dominant in the soda pop, whatever industry.
Right.
And they coordinate with each other so that their sales and everything works against each other. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, but they've done that by buying brands. If you buy Mountain Dew, you're buying Pepsi. If you buy Fanta, you're buying Coke or whatever. I don't know who owns what, but there's, you know, you walk into a store and they're, in fact, here in D.C., there's a couple of convenience stores nearby here that I'll walk into occasionally and get a snack or something. And some are Pepsi stores. They're all Pepsi products, including iced teas, water, bottled water, the colas, all these kind of things. Or you can walk into a Coke store. They're exclusively Coke products. And the same thing with restaurants. What I would say to Pepsi and Coke is, good luck selling Pepsi and Coke. You're entitled to do that all day long. But you have to divest yourself of all these other brands that you've acquired over the last 30 years since Reagan changed the rules of the game, and let Fanta go back to being Fanta, and let A&W Root Beer go back to being Root Beer, and let Mountain Dew go back to being Mountain Dew. Let these companies become standalone companies that compete in the marketplace. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I was just wondering because, you know, if you were to apply that to like AT&T and Verizon, AT&T and Verizon, if they, you know, since they clearly own the majority of the cellular companies, they could easily play the same game, which is just coordinating between the two so that there's virtually no competition, yet they can still pretend they have competition by having competitive sales against each other.
Right. Actually, I think, you know, rather than coming up with an arbitrary number, I think you're right, Luke. An arbitrary number is a dumb idea. Instead, what we should do is go back to the original wording of the Sherman Antitrust Act that says that when a company engages in behavior that tends to monopolize a market or diminishes competition in a market, that company and its senior officers are guilty of a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. It may be dissolved. It may be broken up by government action, and its officers and stockholders may even go to jail. I think we need to go back to that. Luke, thanks a lot for the call. It was a great question. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think we seem to be coming to a consensus that deregulated, unregulated, laissez-faire, libertarian capitalism is absolutely inconsistent with the ideals of Thomas Jefferson. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Cliff watching Free Speech TV in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff. You wanted to comment on driving while impaired?
Afternoon, Tom. But before I get to that point real quick, I recall you saying on one of your programs probably over a year ago that if pot were legal that you would partake.
Yeah.
So if the D.C. law goes into effect, are you still down with joining the pot community?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah. And in fact, yesterday I was on the air and I said, you know, I was in Denver over the weekend and for a board of directors meeting of an organization that I'm on the board of. And, myself and a couple of friends, one of the people that I know, a friend of mine in Denver, had hit the pot store the day before. And Saturday night, he had two different varieties, and we tried them, and I smoked them, and I slept like a baby that night. It was one of the best night's sleep I've had in years.
Yeah, it's probably a little more potent than the pot you smoked back in the 70s, huh?
Well, that was the thing that surprised me, is I keep hearing this from everybody, you know, that modern-day pot is like taking acid, and it's so potent and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, there was pretty good pot back in the late 60s and early 70s. I mean, there was an awful lot of crap stuff, too, but there were, you know, this didn't seem radically different.
No, I remember in high school, if you had the money, you could get the Hawaiian and the
you could buy buds or you could buy seeds and stems. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Depending on your financial situation.
Yeah, but I would, you know, if in Washington D.C. if Washington D.C. legalizes pot, you know, I'm not going to walk around stoned. I'm not going to be doing my show stoned.
No, you're responsible.
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, it doesn't seem practical. You know, it's
exactly. There's a time and place for these things.
But you know, on a weekend or you know at 10 o'clock at night to help me sleep, in a heartbeat.
Okay, good to hear it. Okay, the reason I called was on your big picture program. Maybe a couple weeks ago, you had a gentleman on your panel. I don't remember his name, and I'm not attacking him personally. He was sitting furthest away from you to the right of Medea Benjamin, and he made a statement equating driving on an automobile on pot to driving on alcohol,
right.
But you never talked about, like, amounts consumed. And his position was there was no difference. And you didn't really call him on it, but I'm pretty sure you have a position on that. He got the last word, but it's like a false equivalency for me. What's your position?
Well, I think that both with any intoxicant, there are levels where you're only moderately impaired, which still isn't a good idea. I mean, we know that with one beer, people are slightly more likely to be in a car accident than with none whatsoever. So I think, you know, with any intoxicant, whether it's pot, whether it's alcohol, whether it's, you know, name your favorite drug, that if a person is genuinely impaired, they should not be driving.
Right. But, I mean, if somebody, like, took 5 hits of pot compared to drinking 5 shots of whiskey, you know, the person with the alcohol, I believe, will be physically impaired. Your motor skills get affected. You start slurring your words. You start seeing double. You cross the middle.
No, I know all that, and probably everybody has drank enough to know that. And I can tell you that, you know, that Saturday night in Denver, after having gone through, there were 5 of us, and we went through, I think, 3 or 4 joints of 2 different kinds of pot, I would not have been good to drive. I'll just say it. But I was fine to sleep. And so, Cliff, thanks a lot for the call. You're right. We got to figure out, you know, how do you measure how intoxicated or how impaired a person is? Maybe we're going to go back to the old touch your nose with your finger thing. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. This is Veterans Day week. The American Nurses Foundation wants every American to know about treating post-traumatic stress for you and someone you care about. You can learn more about it at nurseptsdtoolkit.org. And nurseptstoolkit.org is underwriting the Talk Radio News this week, talkradionews.com. And Victoria Jones is with us from the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria, how are you?
Hey, Tom, I'm well, thank you.
Great. So what's going on in the world?
Volkswagen's U.S. division said today it's agreed step to allow for union representation at its plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where the United Auto Workers has faced challenges organizing labor. And as you know, the UAW lost a key vote in February to represent about 1,500 workers at VW's only U.S. plant, but it still claimed it has the backing of a majority of employees. So if the UAW succeeds, this will be the first foreign-owned auto assembly plant in the U.S., the South, where it has bargaining rights.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
Step one.
So that's quite a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Also today, a federal judge struck down South Carolina's same-sex marriage ban as unconstitutional, opening the door to such marriages, also giving the state a week to appeal. U.S. District Judge Richard, I think it's Gergel, I'm hoping he doesn't pronounce it that way, actually, he found the law unconstitutional, invalid as a matter of law, and he blocked any state official from interfering with the plaintiff's rights to be married. But he did rule that the order would not take effect until noon on November the 20th. Now, he said that would allow the Attorney General a chance to appeal to the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia. But the Fourth Circuit already has struck down Virginia's gay marriage ban, which is a ruling that applied to other states in the circuit. And the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal of that case last month. South Carolina is the only state in the circuit that's refused to allow such marriages. So it's kind of looking like going down.
Yeah, yeah. And a fine thing it is, I guess. The ban is going down, right? The ban on gay.
Yes, it's looking like that ban is going to go down, yes.
Great. Okay.
Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, who's on his way to a global economic summit in Australia, plans in an address in Seattle today to implore Asian and European leaders to increase demand and get their economies moving. The world is counting on the U.S. economy to drive the global recovery, but the global economy cannot prosper broadly relying on the United States to be the importer of first and last resort, nor can it rely on the United States to grow fast enough to make up for weak growth in major world economies. And he's going to lay out the president's plan to keep the United States recovery on track. He's also going to strike an optimistic tone in the face of a new Republican Congress, which should be interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's always striking optimistic tones. The question is, what's going to happen?
Exactly. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, incoming Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, and Democratic leader Harry Reid are looking for a deal at the end of the 113th Congress. Now, they've dueled for nearly a decade, as you know, and have gone for quite long periods without even speaking. But they would like to craft a lame duck agreement that would allow both parties to claim some kind of victory. And what Mitch McConnell would like to do is to sort of clear the agenda so that he can start fresh. And Harry Reid wants to clear a whole load of bills. So Reid's priorities are he wants to pass legislation to keep the government open. So does McConnell. Reid wants to provide new funds for the fights against Ebola and ISIS. He also wants to confirm as many of President Obama's nominees as possible. Now, McConnell has his own agenda. He also wants to do the extension of the government funding. He also wants to extend a variety of expired tax provisions. He wants the administration to train and equip Syrian rebels. He wants to extend the Internet tax moratorium, renew the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, and pass the satellite TV bill. So they're going to try and come up with some kind of deal on this.
Very interesting.
It'll be interesting to see if they can.
The devil, quite literally, will be in the details.
No question about that.
Yeah.
As I'm sure you know by now, the U.S. and China struck a climate agreement today, major climate agreement today. So reaction is starting to come in from the Hill. Senator Jim Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma, who is about to take the helm of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee.
Now, this is the guy who wrote the book, Climate Change is a Giant Hoax, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, that he's going to run the Environment Committee.
Right.
Yeah. He calls the deal a non-binding charade. It's hollow and not believable for China to claim it will shift 20% of its energy to non-fossil fuels by 2030.
Oh, I believe they're going to beat that because their people are on the edge of revolt because of the quality of the air.
It's crazy over there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you've got, you know, international runners coming in, having to run races wearing respirators and then be hosed down at the end of the race because their body's covered in caustic chemicals that they just, you know, ran through. I mean, it's, you've got a problem.
You've got a problem.
Yeah.
Beijing, you've got a problem. Senator Rand Paul was taken to task by Fox News host Neil Cavuto for engaging in sexism and ageism against Hillary Clinton this week. In an interview with Politico's Mike Allen, Paul was talking about Clinton and the burden of a campaign in 2016. He said, I think all the polls show if she does run, she'll win the Democrat nomination, said Paul, who's 51. But I don't think it's for certain. It's a very taxing undertaking to go through. It's a rigorous physical ordeal, I think, to be able to campaign for the presidency.
Apparently he's forgotten Ronald Reagan was older than Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And for that matter, I think his dad, Ron Paul, was probably older than Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
In any case, we know what Rand Paul's real agenda is. The question is, would the voters of Kentucky allow him to do it? Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
NursePTSDToolkit.org. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in a third hour of our program. Just a quick reminder, we are raising money. We're trying to put a couple of roofs on a couple of buildings that were built back in the 70s over at the Hunter School. And we're trying to come up with a scholarship fund for kids who can't afford to go to programs like this or whose school districts refuse to cover the cost. Your contributions, this is one of those examples where there basically is no big fundraising company or fundraising infrastructure or apparatus. Your contribution goes directly to help these kids. So hunterschool.org is the website and the telephone number if you'd like to call in and make a donation directly, and you can do it with a credit card or however you'd like. The telephone number is 603-786-2922, 603-786-2922, 2922. So please give them a call or go to hunterschool.org and make a contribution. If it's a $100 donation, they will send you your choice of a T-shirt or an umbrella that says Be the Light. And Be the Light, Be the One. And if you make a contribution of over $1,000, you are more than welcome to come to Washington, D.C., and Louise and I will wine and dine you. And you can hang out with us during either the radio or TV program, your choice, whatever you'd like. Now, all that said, Tom Hartman University is now in session. Boom, boom. We need a bell or something. I don't know. Not quite.
It's a buzzer.
It's a buzzer. Okay. And Dan Sisson is with us. He is the author of The American Revolution of 1800, an adjunct faculty member at Eastern Washington University. And this is an absolutely brilliant book. And we talked about this last week, about the first chapter, as we're moving through the book. Welcome back, Dan.
Well, thank you, Tom.
And you just absolutely great Skype from the university there. Thank the folks at the university for helping put that together as well, Eastern Washington University. Let's talk about a couple of points that you make in the American Revolution of 1800. And if anybody has questions for Dan, want to talk about this, just feel free to give us a shout. Number one, why is it important to talk about an American tradition of revolution? A lot of your book, the American Revolution of 1800, most Americans didn't even learn in school that the election of 1800 was revolutionary. Why is it important for us to talk about revolution?
Well, I think it's important right now because, as many of your viewers might have already seen, a study at Princeton and Northwestern University just declared that democracy in America is dead. And we are now an oligarchy, that we can no longer claim to be a democratic society. And of course, once you take that step, then you've done away with the Declaration of Independence and the whole idea of equality. And then once you've gone to an oligarchy, you can no longer say you're a republic. And so an oligarchy is only the barest nod toward constitutional government. And so Jefferson and his fellow revolutionaries all believed that the thing that we should always strive to do is to make sure that we were revolutionary, but we were revolutionary for the right reasons. We stood for the right principles. The whole idea of depriving 1.2 million people of their votes in, say, in Texas in the last election is not what the American revolutionary tradition is about. I mean, what Jefferson envisioned and all of his friends was that we would help people get the vote. We would expand the suffrage. And Jefferson is on record as saying that the suffrage is the most important thing that we have developed to keep people free.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about revolution, why was the election of 1800 a revolution? Why the American Revolution of 1800?
Well, because the Revolution of 1800 faced many of the problems that we face today. If you looked at the Adams administration and you saw that within the administration, there was a huge faction which was driving toward creating wealth for a privileged few, that Hamilton had identified with the British imperial system. So the whole issue about imperialism was a part of this generation. There was never the form was something that we had achieved. That is, we had had a republic in terms of the Constitution, but it takes more than just a form to be able to do this. Jefferson and those guys all were concerned about how we might fall back. We might just be, you know, the habits of an aristocracy are very difficult to break, as we can see in our own time, you know, with the evolution of the corporation and what they did in the 2007, 2008, 2009, et cetera. And we have money, as, you know, everybody says, the bottom line, it's all about money. And this is what an aristocratic society is about. A democratic society is always talking in terms of what is the way that we're going to benefit the vast majority of people. Are we going to make education free to our younger generation? Are we, you know, are we going to improve the roads and all this sort of stuff? Not paying necessarily attention to corporate profits is what we've become. And this is a sign that Jefferson would, if he were alive today, he would be looking around and he would be saying, these are all the things that we know will lead to the British imperial system. I mean, that was their experience.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
How did the British not end up with, or do they have an oligarchy now as well? Is post-Thatcher UK an oligarchy?
Well, I think that it's a mix. I think that they give lip service to democratic freedoms when they have Parliament, you know, passing laws. But when you look at that system closely, what you find out, even today, and this is like 200 and some years later, they have a profound rotten borough system. They buy people their seats in Parliament. And everybody knows this, and everybody goes along with it. We see that in America today as corruption. And if you look at all the money that's been infused as a result of Citizens United, it's hard to see or not see that this is what we're doing. We're buying seats for parties. And so when you think about the Conservative Party or the Labor Party, they have apportioned very carefully, you know, the amount of money that they're going to spend, the number of seats that they can have. And so if you go back to Jefferson's era, or actually right before that, when Robert Walpole was the minister of England for about a 25-year period, one of the things that they did was they perfected this rotten borough system. They could buy out just enough to get the majority. That's all they wanted. And then they could carry the motions in Parliament. But they also established a national bank, the Bank of England, in which they used that as a base for patronage to give out to people that would do what the regime wanted. And, of course, they had patent of monopolies. And from my point of view, you look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade negotiations that are taking place, and what we're doing is we're giving people monopolies. So we are, in essence, emulating what the we might call the right-wing conservatives or the Imperial Party did at the time that Jefferson was alive. It's an incredible cycle that seems to be repeating itself, and we've got to figure out some way to get people alerted and informed to prevent this from happening.
Dan, a minute to the break. Haven't we seen that cycle repeat itself a number of times in American history prior to the Civil War, at the end of the Gilded Age, after the Great Depression?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the Gilded Age is the best reference. We were still operating under the landed aristocracy in the South when we got up into the 1850s. And what we saw was political polarization. If you thought about it in terms of parties becoming factions, there's no more radical group than, say, the factions in South Carolina, who just denounced the Constitution and the reason behind it and all the rest. And so we're seeing an awful lot of that. In the Gilded Age, it was purely a matter of wealth, and we talk about the Senate being the Millionaires Club. I think that's been repeated today.
Yeah, fascinating. I want to get into three ideas in the revolutionary tradition, the difference between revolution and rebellion, and Jefferson's interest in these principles. We'll continue with Dan Sisson, the author of The American Revolution of 1800, in today's Tom Hartmann University Book Club discussion. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Dan Sisson will be right back with us. American Revolution of 1800 is the book. And welcome back. Jesse watching Free Speech TV in Miami, Florida on the Dish Network. Jesse, you have a question for Dan Sisson?
Yeah. Hi, Tom, Dan. If the Founding Fathers could be in the Democrats today, would you think with the money controlling everything as it is, they started their revolution with no taxation without representation. Would you think now that they could look at with the, instead of tax, work has no representation, the way the corporation and ownership is controlling things? Would you say they would change no taxation without representation to no work without representation? That's the question.
Interesting question, Jesse. Thank you.
Yeah, it is. And my response would be that we have the reverse of what happened in the American Revolution. We have a legislative branch now that is determined to do away with taxation for corporations, or approximately so, and they want to raise taxes on the people least able to afford to pay them. I think that that's an unhealthy development for the country, and the vast majority of people are going to be under that burden, and I don't think that they're going to take it laying down after a certain point. So what we're really talking about here is the potential for revolution.
Hmm. The potential. When you say potential for revolution, what do you mean, Dan?
I mean that there will be groups all across America who suffer as a result of the agenda that is about to be imposed on us in January. And that is, you know, when your children can't go to decent schools, when you can't find work, when you can't get enough to eat because all of the welfare programs and the nutrition programs have been cut, you're not going to take it laying down. I mean, some people might, but eventually there's going to be groups of people all over the country who begin to resist against this. And we're seeing that money buys elections. So if the law that was passed by the Supreme Court, you know, just a few months ago, Citizens United, is not repealed,
and McCutcheon,
my guess is we're going to see an increase in the amount of money spent, and we won't even know where it's coming from. Hmm. And that's going to turn the elections in favor of the aristocrats or the wealthy.
Right.
So what are the people at the bottom going to do? I mean, traditionally, historically, they will begin to protest, and that will lead to even more protests. And the thing about oligarchs is this is often called iron rule. And the term iron rule means that these people show no mercy. They do not relinquish their power. And so that power is going to have to be wrested from them.
Hmm. And that does not necessarily mean with guns, though, does it?
It doesn't have to be. Jefferson was a believer in peaceful revolution. In fact, if you think about, if you were to dissect Jefferson and Madison's ideas of revolution, they would tell you that the only way to have a real revolution in which you protect and expand people's rights is to do it peacefully, do it rationally, and do it according to the Constitution. And what Jefferson did in the Revolution of 1800 was to show us all the tools that could be used, the way you can use the forms to have a peaceful revolution. And it works.
Yeah, remarkable. Dan Sisson is with us. Professor Dan Sisson and Dr. Dan Sisson is with us. We'll be back with more of his comments on Revolution, America, Thomas Jefferson, and the American Revolution of 1800, his new book. We'll be right back. Reminder, we're raising funds for the Hunter School this week. The telephone number is 603-786-2922, 603-786-2922 to make a contribution. With a $100 donation, you'll get a T-shirt or an umbrella that says, be the one, be the light, be the one. And with a $1,000 contribution, you can come to D.C. and Louise and I will take you out to dinner and you can hang out during the TV or radio show of your choice. And any amount is actually a really big deal. It is fully tax deductible. It's a 501c3 organization, a nonprofit. And that's why it's an actual nonprofit that's actually doing good work for kids as opposed to, you know, running political ads or something like that. Professor Dan Sisson is on the line with us, professor at Eastern Washington University. He's the author of the book, The American Revolution of 1800, that just came out recently in a reissued edition in the last 6 months or so. And it's an absolutely brilliant analysis of not only what happened in 1800, but what's happening today. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you.
You just made a point. I'd like you to repeat it about, you said, you know, as the oligarchy turns more and more into iron rule, that eventually revolution happens. And then you made the point that Jefferson and Madison believed in peaceful revolution. What is that?
A peaceful revolution is when you use the forms allowed by the Constitution, the democratic reforms. And I refer to it in shorthand as a possibility of permanent, peaceful, democratic revolution to save a republic. And so if you look at the Republican forms, we have the right to vote. We have the right to organize. We have democracy. We had democracy in this country, which meant that we were all equal before the law. And what you do is you use those principles and those forms of organization to organize the body politic. Education is a major issue for Jefferson. If you read the book, what you find out is that beginning in the 1790s, 1794, 95, they are organizing county by county throughout many of the southern states and the middle states in America, and they're going out to county meetings, political meetings. They didn't have parties as we call them today, but they had people who would get together to voice their complaints or their demands or whatever, and they would send representatives out. They would have leaflets. They had pamphlets that they were printing all the time to address these issues locally. So you would have a guy like Christopher Gadsden down in South Carolina writing day and night, literally publishing dozens of pamphlets to educate the voters. And this is, we just take this for granted that it's all on television, that it's all, you know, in the newspapers. And yet we know that the newspapers have been captured and are dominated by a few corporations. And we hope that the internet isn't going to be the same. So we got to utilize these modern forms of communication in a way that educates the public. And what we're finding out again and again is that people don't know about the issues. So something is not right here. I mean, in other words, we've got to somehow direct, you know, texting and Skype and all of the other forms so that people begin to really understand what's taking place in their political society.
Right.
And that's what Jefferson would say.
So if you had to identify three areas in Jefferson's revolutionary tradition, what would they be?
Well, one would be the Constitution. The Constitution sort of sets the boundaries for us in terms of what is permissible in our society. It means that you're not going to get together with a bunch of guys with rifles and submachine guns and try to face down the BLM or some other group of people. That's not acceptable. And if you begin to operate by the Constitution and you advocate peaceful means, what you're engaging in is persuasion. So that's rationalism. What Jefferson believed, that along with the Constitution, that we should always use reason so that we can persuade people what is in the best interest of the community. And if you talk to somebody long enough and point out the things that they're going to suffer if they take a certain course, the chances are that they're going to see the light. It may take a while, but, you know, eventually you will develop that majority which will carry the day. I think the other thing that Jefferson and Madison were both extremely concerned about was the possibilities of provoking military action against any kind of evolving revolution or even rebellion. They were very much aware that the police and the military had the power to be able to destroy any movement. And whether it's by infiltration, and there was plenty of that at the time of 1800, or whether it was by, you know, strictly the use of force. One of the things that Jefferson and Madison both agreed on and wrote back and forth was that you have to make the revolution just short of challenging the military so that it will intervene. Because once that happens, then it's over. You're not going to get people back together, or it's going to turn into something that's so violent that you can't control it. And that's a real possibility. Right. So in our time, when we look at the military, they have the preponderance of military power and force on their side. The people really do not have it. This just gets back to our Second Amendment issues again. But I think that Madison and Jefferson would say every time they talk to somebody about rebellion or revolution that we must be careful not to provoke the military authorities.
Fascinating. And this is one of the reasons why they wanted to put such constraints on the military. You know, you can only appropriate money for 2 years, Article 1, Section 8.
Absolutely. And they all did. John Adams, who we criticized for passing and signing the Alien and Sedition Laws, saw in Alexander Hamilton a total threat to his administration, and he was the leading general in the country at that moment, and he said, "This we can't let this go on," and so he abolished the army. Can you imagine that?
John Adams abolished the army?
That's right. Took away all the appropriations.
Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. We're talking with historian Dan Sisson. His new book, The American Revolution of 1800. It's our Tom Hartman University Book Club meeting today. We'll be back with your questions for Dan and a few more of mine right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And please help out the Hunter School. This is a great organization that really and truly needs your help. 603-786-2922. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dan Sisson on the line with us, the author of The American Revolution of 1800. New book. Just a quick note, we're raising money for the Hunter School in New Hampshire. The number is 603 to make a donation, and I would love to get 100 people making a $1,000 donation so that I could take 100 people out to dinner, and we could hit our goal of we'd like to get more than 100,000, but we've got a couple of roofs, and we want to have a scholarship fund, and this is our goal for the week. Please call 603, but even, you know, $10 gifts, $20 gifts, $5, whatever you can afford, 50, whatever, 100, 200, with a $100 gift. A Be the Light t-shirt or umbrella with a $1,000 gift. Come to D.C. and Louise and I'll wine you and dine you. And pot's not legal here in D.C. yet, so that's all we can do. Anyway, it's the telephone number is 603-786-2922 for Hunter School. Please give them a call. 603-786-2922 or hunterschool.org. You can donate online. Back to Dan Sisson. Hey, Dan.
Hi there, John.
And thanks for being with us. I have got, every single line. Danielle was just commenting to me. We get more calls of people who want to talk to you than anybody other than Bernie Sanders. So you're doing good.
Oh, wow.
Let's pick up some callers here and let you bounce off these things. And if you can keep your answers kind of short so we can get through a whole bunch of them, okay?
Right on.
Okay. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Paul, you're on the air with Dan Sisson.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dan. Question. What do you think is likely to be the eventual result of the unequal or unrepresentative nature of the United States Senate? When you look at the combined population of states that are now represented by the majority in the Republican Senate, which will be in January, 54 senators represent a population. I'm talking states like Wyoming, Alaska, Kansas, some of these states that don't even have a million people, whereas the Democratic states, California, New York, Illinois, these are represented by Democratic senators. There's a far greater population represented, and yet when we look at the cost of these races, it's far, put it this way, Dianne Feinstein's race in 2012, she won by 7.5 million votes. Her margin of victory was 7.5 million votes.
That's almost four times the population of the state of Kansas, which is represented by two Republican senators. What do you think of that, Dan?
Right. Well, you're hitting directly at the foundation of our republic, because when the Electoral College was set up, one of the things that they did was they tried to make it possible to control the elections if things went awry. In other words, they wanted to have that last-minute ability to manipulate an election. We saw that in our own time in close elections in 2000, etc. And you're not going to change that until you get rid of the Electoral College and simply vote on the basis of population. You have to have a constitutional amendment.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. You're on the air with Dan Sisson.
Hi. I called about the libertarian guy and the taxation on tobacco, which was our original currency, right, back in the 1800s. But I wonder, these arguments that these libertarians make, about free markets and as if they even ever existed. I wonder, if, having written your book about the 1800s, how do you interpret now this very trendy, very snooty libertarianism, like I'm a nerd and better than everybody, and I understand how the world works. I mean, is that consistent with this our country even back then? Or
that's a great question. My response would be that the people who that I know that are libertarians are people who have not matured fully in their understanding of what we would call democratic theory, with the obligations that that theory imposes on all of us. They act selfishly. I mean, their great leader was Ayn Rand, and Ayn Rand could have cared less about either democracy or majorities or any other concept that we know in terms of our democratic theory. In terms of your reference to 1800 and tobacco, you should know that I was a tobacco farmer. I took four crops of tobacco to market and got the highest prices in Southern Maryland when I was younger. And I said at one point, and with our family met, the studies that Laura Lard and others had been suppressing came out, and we said we're not going to give people cancer anymore, so we just stopped selling tobacco. But tobacco was the currency of the period, and in the 40s and 50s in the United States, it still had sway in the state of Maryland and some of the southern states. So that's how they saw the world, was through their special interests.
Remarkable. Ken in Polson, Montana, you're on the air with Professor Sisson.
Yes. Good afternoon or morning, whatever it is. I have something to do with a change that I would like to see happen in our taxation system. And again, this would be a revolutionary thing, and it would be FICA tax. And I believe that every citizen should pay into our FICA tax to pay for Social Security and also Medicare and Medicaid. And my proposal would be that everybody pays on their gross income, no matter what their gross income is, and it would reduce the FICA tax for every working man and make every...
Right. So what you're proposing, Ken, is to do away with the cap on FICA. Right.
Well, no, I'm changing, not doing away with a cap on FICA. I'm saying that everybody that has income of any kind.
Oh, apply FICA to capitalists as well as to laborers. So
that's
the capital gains. Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. Your thoughts, Dan?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking it sounds to me like it's parallel to the Social Security tax. We have a limit on Social Security taxes.
FICA tax is the Social Security tax.
Yeah. If you make, all right, okay, so if you make more than $190,000 a year, you don't pay anything past that.
I think it's
right?
$118,000. And okay. Also, if you make your money with money, in other words, if you're Mitt Romney, if you're making your money as dividends, they're not taxed for Social Security purposes. So what he's suggesting is that the capitalists, people who make their money with money, should also have to pay FICA taxes just like the rest of us who work for a living.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay. Do you think the founders would have?
It would depend on where you lived. If you were in Massachusetts, they may have gone along with it. But if you were in Virginia, I don't know. I don't think our notions had advanced at that point. We didn't have a tax, for individuals at that point. So there was really very little discussion about it.
Right. It was all tariffs and sales taxes.
That's right. Imports.
Yeah. Remarkable. Gary in Columbus, Ohio. You're on the air with Dan Sisson.
Hi, Tom and Dan. I wanted to call and talk to you guys about the actual issue with the foundation of our government. And what I mean by that is when our government was first founded, it was widely believed that up until the 1850s, only white male property owners could vote. And not only that, but James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, as you guys had referenced earlier in the show, actually supported anti-federalist, anti-centrist, and states' rights issues and policies. And that had continued up until essentially the Civil War in the 1860s. And so, again, to get to my question, is there an issue with the foundation of our government? And if so, what do we need to change and what do we need to address here?
Well, let me respond by saying that that your mention of federalism, which has a bad connotation in terms of states' rights in our time because of this racial issue, doesn't necessarily have to be that way as seen by the founding fathers. The founders believed that what federalism did was to divide power between the states and the national government and allow on certain issues the community, the people in the community, to be able to change any way they wanted. And they made federalism one of the, I mean, Jefferson actually said that federalism was one of the greatest things ever invented by man to reduce the power of a central government. As you know, in our Constitution, there are things that the federal government can't touch. Only the states can do. And this is something that we need to pay more attention to, especially when you talk about revolution. If we can start to revolutionize states, and we got 50 of them now, you know, you get 35 or 40 states to be on one principle or issue, you've got the majority. And that can change. You can go, you know, on if you say you state 7 or 8 major issues that you're concerned about, then this was Jefferson and Madison's idea. When you get a majority that supports it, then you've got the country moving in the right direction. And if it's consistent with the Constitution, then that's a constitutional revolution on that issue.
Right. And just for the record, at the founding of the Republic, there was no provision that said it was debated at the Constitutional Convention, but there was no provision that said only white men could vote or that said that only landholders could vote. In fact, there were women who were voting. There were African Americans who were voting at the time, you know, right after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Correct?
Correct.
Yes. So,
yeah, and I also, you know, you have to separate out those old property qualifications and, you know, the things like estates where the male got everything if he married a woman. Those things were legacies of an aristocratic society.
Right. Yeah, in
if
fact, Jefferson was so proud of trying to get rid of primogeniture.
Absolutely.
The oldest son inherits everything, which he had benefited from, and he was committed to destroying. We're talking with Dan Sisson, historian and author of the new book, The American Revolution of 1800. Dan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, Tom.
Good talking with you.
Great to be here.
We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The book, once again, The American Revolution of 1800 by Dan Sisson. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dan had to run. He had to teach a class. So we let him go at 45 after. But I'm here, and maybe I can answer some questions or just take some comments. Paul, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network in Benton, Pennsylvania. Paul, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. You know, it's just kind of like an observation of mine where, you know, it's like people know they're being screwed. And what happens is, like, half of them are, like, too dumb to know they're being screwed, and the other half is so dumb, they go out and they join the Tea Party and stock up on ammo and vote for the people who are screwing them. And
right.
No matter how many pamphlets you write, how many websites you have and books and everything else, you cannot force people to educate themselves. If they paid as much attention to politics and government, as much as they do the sports and for like Hollywood gossip, I mean, my God, I mean, you know, we'd be incredible. But it's like a lot of them, you know, I try and talk to people and stuff, and they don't want to hear it.
I don't disagree, and this is one of the reasons why I think it's so important that we all be politically active, that we all be agents of education, that we all be agents of change. We've got to do these things. Thank you for the call, Paul. Excellent point. William in Pittsford, New York. Hey, William, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I was inspired to pick up the Federalist Papers after reading The Crash of 2016. And the conservative Republicans really need to take a page from the lessons of our founders. I was reading Federalist number 31 in Alexander Hamilton discussing the general power of taxation. And there are a couple quotes that really strike me from that, like right here. Thus far, the ends of public happiness will be promoted by supplying the wants of government, and all beyond this is unworthy of our care or anxiety. How can its administration be anything else than a succession of expedients temporizing, impotent, disgraceful? How will it be able to avoid a frequent sacrifice of its engagement and immediate necessity? How can it undertake or execute any liberal or enlarged plans of public good? So the founders seem to really understand that the federal government is a medium for public good.
Yeah.
And when did the Republicans really kind of distort this to make it seem like the government is the enemy? I mean,
that's been going on it's been going on since before the Civil War, certainly.
Well, I think this is a message that the people really need to get out. And I mean, it's information that's widely available. So what can we do to get this message out?
Right. Also in the Federalist Papers, there's a place where Hamilton talks about why they wrote the Constitution as broadly as possible and why the general welfare clause is in there and why general welfare is mentioned several times in the Constitution. And he just comes right out and says, we wanted to make it as broad as possible to give future generations and future legislatures as much latitude as possible to promote the general welfare, to do what is necessary for we the people. And, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing.
One more thing I would like to tack on there is he said, the moment we launch into conjectures about the usurpations of the federal government, we get into an unfathomable abyss and fairly put ourselves out of the reach of all reasoning.
Wow. Amazing. William, thank you. Thanks for sharing that. I've made a note. I'm going to have to go look up Federalist 31. It's been a long time since I read all the way through them all. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour, and we are raising money for the Hunter School, a program that Louise and I started back in 1978 in New Hampshire. Started out as a program for abused kids, now is a school for children with autism spectrum challenges and in some cases brilliances, ADHD, Asperger's, this whole spectrum. And Ryan Barber is on the line with us. He is a member of the staff. He's one of the house parents at the Hunter School. HunterSchool.org, by the way, is the the website where you can make a donation, or you can call to make a donation right now at 603-786-2922. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. It's nice to see you. Thanks for calling in and Skyping in.
Not a problem.
Tell me first about the labyrinth.
Oh, well, we built the labyrinth a few years ago. A couple of the people on the team started looking into researching labyrinths a little bit and, you know, the history of them and how they have been used throughout history in sort of a meditative way to basically the effects is to sort of shut down part of the brain in order to, you know, the part that makes decisions in order to, because basically the labyrinth guides you through to the center. The center being, you know, the most within part of the self, and then it guides you back out. So it's essentially a guided journey, you know, an outer form of a guided inner journey.
And you guys built a labyrinth, which is maybe a 100-foot diameter circle, or you could correct me on the size, and it's made with little stones, and so you walk this labyrinth, and it's a beautiful, elaborate path. one way in, one way out. And how do the kids use this?
Well, every morning after they eat, before going to school, they walk through just to sort of give them a moment of self-reflection. Mm-hmm. Again, it sort of helps them take out that decision-making part of themselves for the moment of walking through. And they take a stone, which they sort of put their intention for the day in, try to, you know, put a positive intention in. And when they get to the center, there's sort of a little mosaic altar, which they put that in, representing sort of putting their intention into the center of themselves and then being able to come out and start their day that way.
Hmm.
So that it's just one of the things we do here to help kids who, you know, have a difficult time getting to that peaceful state of mind into a peaceful state of mind, and a lot of them really appreciate it, I think.
So it has a consequential effect on the kids?
Sure, yep.
Yeah, remarkable. We talked earlier with the mother of one of the Hunter School kids who said that Hunter School has saved his life. We're raising money, by the way, for the Hunter School. The number is 603-786-2922. With a $100 gift, you get a Be the Light, Be the One t-shirt or umbrella. With a $1,000 gift, you can come to Washington, D.C., and Louise and I will take you out to dinner or lunch, whatever you'd prefer, and you can come watch the show being produced. So, Ryan, tell us, you know, without revealing, you know, respecting the confidentiality of the kids, we have mom's permission and the child's permission to talk about him, but I don't want to use his name and I don't want to, you know, be super identify him. But his mom talked about how he was not verbal when he went off to the school, and everybody said, oh, you know, forget about this kid, he'll never read, he'll never talk, he's just, you know, he's toast.
Well, that particular kid didn't say much when he first got here. In fact, he used to have times when he would have sort of, because trying to express himself, he would do a lot of physical outbursts, sort of make noises, not using words, but just making sounds, jump around, things like that. And over the course of the time he's been here, that person who came here really isn't in our house at all. He really just sits quietly. He's able to have, you know, not full-on conversations, but he can express himself with words. He's able to understand everything you say, and he's able to very, very well do a direction. If you ask him to do a simple task, he's actually quite good at doing that. And those outbursts and stuff really are very, very rare. And even if it does happen, it's more of to, you know, for fun. It's not to try to express himself in a way which he couldn't do before.
Hmm.
So he's really one of our, in our house, the person you're talking about is one of the model kids, because he's very peaceful all the time, pretty much in the house.
Wow.
You know, he's respectful. And
he's one of the children in your home, in the house that you're the husband for.
Yes, he is, actually, yes. And I'm one of four house parents in that house that helps take care of him.
Yeah.
And if some of the other kids are sort of getting a little bit hyperactive, a little bit uncentered, then he'll be one to sort of point at them and, you know, give them a little, time to quiet down. You know, he'll let them know.
Wow.
But not in an aggressive way, very, very quietly and very respectfully.
Yeah, that's remarkable. We're talking with Ryan Barber. He's a house parent at the Hunter School. The website is hunterschool.org. The telephone number, if you'd like to make a donation, and please do. This is the end of the year. This is, or we're close to the end of the year. This will be our annual fundraiser for the Hunter School and our holiday season fundraiser. This is an opportunity to give a gift that will literally change the lives of young people. 603-786-2922. 603-786-2922. 603-786-2922. Ryan, we have about a minute left. Can you describe energetic mindfulness in that period of time?
Well, you know, in public institutions, there's a lot of stuff that sort of goes unseen and not talked about. But one of the things we focus on at the Hunter School is understanding not just, you know, the physical part of learning, but also how, you know, the electrical and energetic aspect of ourselves and kids and how that interacts. So what we try to get them to understand is how their thoughts actually affect the energetic field around them, and how that can, by having a better control over their thoughts, positive or negative, that can actually affect, you know, their aura, their energy, and that can affect how they influence the world and how the world influences them. So that's one of the things that we do talk about and teach and try to get kids to be more aware of.
That's wonderful and powerful stuff. Ryan Barber, you're doing God's work. Thanks so much for being with us, Ryan.
Thank you. Take care.
Great talking with you. And to make a donation to the Hunter School, 603-786-2922 is the telephone number, 603-786-2922. Or you can go to hunterschool.org and click on the donate button. $1,000, and Louise and I will take you out to dinner here in D.C. and show you a really good time. So please consider making a contribution, making a gift. It's fully tax deductible for the Hunter School. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.